not since.
No, not since, said Clary. Jace called me and told me Alec and Isabel were okay. Apparently their parents are racing back from Idris, now that someone finally actually told them what's going on. They'll be here in a couple of days.
Was it weird, hearing from Jace?
Asked Simon, his voice carefully neutral.
I mean, since you found out.
His voice trailed off. Yes, said Clary, her voice sharply edged. Since I found out what? That he's a killer transvestite who molests cats?
No wonder that cat of his hates everyone.
Oh, shut up, Simon, Clary said crossly. I know what you mean, and no, it wasn't weird. Nothing ever happened between us anyway.
Nothing?
Echoed Simon, disbelief plain in his tone. Nothing, Clary repeated firmly, glancing out the window so that he wouldn't see the blood staining her cheeks. They were passing a row of restaurants, and she could see talkies, brightly lit in the gathering twilight. They turned the corner just as the sun disappeared behind the rose window of the Institute, flooding the street below with seashell light that only they could see. Simon pulled up in front of the door and killed the engine, jittering the keys in his hand.
Do you want me to go up with you?
She hesitated. No, I should do this on my own. She saw the look of disappointment flicker across his face, but it vanished quickly. Simon, she thought, had grown up a lot in these past 2 weeks, just as she had. Which was good, since she wouldn't have wanted to leave him behind. He was part of her, as much as her drawing talent, the dusty air of Brooklyn, her mother's laughter, and her own shadow hunter blood.
All right, he said. Are you going to need a ride later?
She shook her head. Luke gave me money for a cab. Want to come over tomorrow, though? She added. We could watch some Trigun, pop some corn. I could use some couch time. He nodded.
That sounds good.
He leaned forward then and brushed a kiss along her cheekbone. It was a kiss as light as a blown leaf, but she felt a shiver far down in her bones. She looked at him. Do you think that it was a coincidence? She asked.
Do I think what was a coincidence?
That we wound up in Pandemonium the same night that Jace and the others just happened to be there, pursuing a demon? The night before Valentine came for my mother? Simon shook his head.
I don't believe in coincidences, he said.
Neither do I.
But I have to admit, Simon added. Coincidence or not, it turned out to be a fortuitous occurrence.
The fortuitous occurrences, said Clary. Now there's a band name for you.
It's better than most of the ones we've come up with, Simon admitted.
You bet. She jumped down out of the van, slamming the door behind her. She heard him honk as she ran up the path to the door between the slabs of overgrown grass and waved without turning around. The interior of the cathedral was cool and dark and smelled of rain and damp paper. Her footsteps echoed loudly on the stone floor, and she thought of Jace in the church in Brooklyn.
There might be a god, Clary, and there might not. Either way, we're on our own.
In the elevator, she stole a look at herself in the mirror as the door clanged shut behind her. Most of her bruises and scrapes had healed to invisibility. She wondered if Jace had ever seen her looking as prim as she did today. She'd dressed for the hospital in a black pleated skirt, pink lip gloss, and a vintage sailor-collared blouse. She thought she looked about 8. Not that it mattered what Jace thought about how she looked, she reminded herself, now or ever. She wondered if they'd ever be the way Simon was with his sister, a mixture of boredom and loving irritation. She couldn't imagine it. She heard the loud meows before the elevator door even opened. Hey, Church, she said, kneeling down by the wriggling gray ball on the floor. Where is everyone? Church, who clearly wanted his stomach rubbed, muttered ominously. With a sigh, Clary gave in. Demented cat, she said, rubbing with vigor. Where?
Clary!
It was Isabel, swooping into the foyer in a long red skirt, her hair piled on top of her head with jeweled clips.
It's so great to see you!
She descended on Clary with a hug that nearly overbalanced her.
Isabel! Clary gasped.
It's good to see you too, she added, letting Isabel pull her up to a standing position.
I was so worried about you, said Isabel brightly. After you guys went off to the library with Hodge, and I was with Alec, I heard the most terrific banging explosion. And when I got to the library, of course, you were gone and everything was strewn all over the floor. And there was blood and sticky black goo everywhere.
She shuddered. What was that stuff?
A curse, Clary said quietly. Hodge's curse.
Oh, right, Isabel said. Jace told me about Hodge.
He did?
Clary was surprised.
That he got the curse taken off him and left.
Yeah, he did.
I would have thought he'd have stayed to say goodbye, Isabel added. I'm kind of disappointed in him.
But I guess he was scared of the Clave. He'll get in touch eventually, I bet.
So Jace hadn't told them that Hodge had betrayed them, Clary thought, not sure how she felt about that. Then again, if Jace was trying to spare Isabel confusion and disappointment, maybe she shouldn't interfere.
Anyway, Isabel went on, it was horrible, and I don't know what I would have done if Magnus hadn't showed up and magicked Alec back to health.
Is that a word? Magicked?
She crinkled her eyebrows.
Jace told us all about what happened on the island afterward. Actually, we knew about it even before because Magnus was on the phone about it all night. Everyone in Downworld was buzzing about it.
You're famous, you know.
Me?
Sure. Valentine's daughter.
Clary shuddered. So I guess Jace is famous too.
You're both famous, said Isabel in the same overbright voice. The famous brother and sister.
Clary looked at Isabel curiously.
I didn't expect you to be this glad to see me, I have to admit.
The other girl put her hands on her hips indignantly.
Why not?
I didn't think you liked me all that much.
Isabel's brightness faded and she looked down at her silvery toes.
I didn't think I did either, she admitted.
But when I went to look for you and Jace and you were gone,
her voice trailed off.
I wasn't just worried about him, I was worried about you too. There's something so reassuring about you. And Jace is so much better when you're around.
Clary's eyes widened.
He is?
He is, actually. Less sharp-edged somehow. It's not so much that he's kinder, but that he lets you see the kindness in him.
She paused.
And I guess I resented you at first, but I realize now that was stupid. Just because I've never had a friend who was a girl doesn't mean I couldn't learn how to have one.
Me too, actually, said Clary.
And Isabel?
Yeah?
You don't have to pretend to be nice. I like it better when you just act like yourself.
Bitchy, you mean, Isabel said, and laughed. Clary was about to protest when Alec swung into the entryway on a pair of crutches. One of his legs was bandaged, his jeans rolled up to his knee, and there was another bandage on his temple, under the dark hair. Otherwise, he looked remarkably healthy for someone who'd nearly died 4 days before. He waved a crutch in greeting.
Hi, Clary said, surprised to see him up and around. Are you all right?
I'm fine, Alec said. I won't even need these in a few days. Guilt swelled her throat. If it hadn't been for her, Alec wouldn't be on crutches at all.
I'm really glad you're okay, Alec, she said, putting every ounce of sincerity into her voice that she could muster.
Alec blinked.
Thanks.
So Magnus fixed you? Clary said.
Luke said.
He did, said Isabel. It was so awesome. He showed up and ordered everyone out of the room and shut the door. Blue and red sparks kept exploding out into the hallway from underneath the door.
I don't remember any of it, said Alec.
Then he sat by Alec's bed all night and into the morning to make sure he woke up okay, Isabel added.
I don't remember that either, Alec added hastily.
Isabel's red lips curved into a smile. I wonder how Magnus knew to come.
I asked him, but he wouldn't say.
Clary thought of the folded paper Hodge had thrown into the fire after Valentine had gone. He was a strange man, she thought, who'd taken the time to do what he could to save Alec even while betraying everyone and everything he'd ever cared about.
I don't know, she said.
Isabel shrugged.
I guess he heard about it somewhere.
He does seem to be hooked into an enormous gossip network. He's such a girl.
He's the High Warlock of Brooklyn, Isabel, Alec reminded her, but not without some amusement.
He turned to Clary.
Jace is up in the greenhouse if you want to see him, he said. I'll walk you.
You will?
Sure.
Alec looked only slightly uncomfortable.
Why not?
Clary glanced at Isabel, who shrugged. Whatever Alec was up to, he hadn't shared it with his sister.
Go on, said Isabel. I've got stuff to do anyway.
She waved a hand at them.
Shoo.
They set off down the hallway together. Alec's pace was fast, even on crutches. Clary had to jog to keep up.
I have short legs, she reminded him.
Sorry. He slowed down, contrite. Look, he began, those things you said to me when I yelled at you about Jace.
I remember, she said in a small voice.
When you told me that that it was because...
He seemed to be having trouble forming a complete sentence.
He tried again.
When you said I was...
Alec, don't.
Sure.
Never mind. He clamped his lips together. You don't want to talk about it.
It's not that. It's that I feel awful about what I said. It was horrible. It wasn't true at all.
But it was true, said Alec. Every word.
That doesn't make it okay, she said. Not everything that's true needs to be said. It was mean, and when I said Jace had told me you'd never killed a demon, he said it was because you were always protecting him and Isabel. It was a good thing he was saying about you. Jace can be a jerk, but he...
loves you, she was about to say, and stopped.
Never said a bad word about you to me, ever, I swear.
You don't have to swear, he said. I know already. He sounded calm, even confident in a way she'd never heard him sound before. She looked at him, surprised. I know I didn't kill Abaddon either, but I appreciate you telling me I had. She laughed shakily.
You appreciate me lying to you?
You did it out of kindness, he said. That means a lot, that you would be kind to me even after how I treated you.
I think Jace would have been pretty pissed at me for lying if he hadn't been so upset at the time, said Clary. Not as mad as he would be if he knew what I'd said to you before, though.
I've got an idea, said Alec, his mouth turning up at the corners. Let's not tell him. I mean, maybe Jace can behead a Ducienne demon from a distance of 50 feet with just a corkscrew and a rubber band, but sometimes I think he doesn't know much about people.
I guess so, Clary grinned. They'd reached the bottom of the spiral staircase that led to the roof.
I can't go up.
Alec tapped his crutch against a metal step. It rang tinnily. It's okay. I can find my way. He made as if to turn away, then glanced back at her.
I should have guessed you were Jace's sister, he said. You both have the same artistic talent.
Clary paused, her foot on the lowest stair. She was taken aback.
Jace can draw?
Nah.
When Alec smiled, his eyes lit like blue lamps, and Clary could see what Magnus had found so captivating about him.
I was just kidding. He can't draw a straight line.
Chuckling, he swung away on his crutches. Clary watched him go, bemused. An Alec who cracked jokes and poked fun at Jace was something she could get used to, even if his sense of humor was somewhat inexplicable. The greenhouse was just as she'd remembered it, though the sky above the glass roof was sapphire now. The clean, soapy smell of the flowers cleared her head. Breathing in deeply, she pushed her way through the tightly woven leaves and branches. She found Jace sitting on the marble bench in the middle of the greenhouse. His head was bent, and he seemed to be turning an object over in his hands, idly. He looked up as she ducked under a branch and quickly closed his hand around the object.
Clary,
he sounded surprised.
What are you doing here?
I came to see you, she said. I wanted to know how you were.
I'm fine.
He was wearing jeans and a white t-shirt. She could see his still fading bruises, like the dark spots on the white flesh of an apple. Of course, she thought, the real injuries were internal, hidden from every eye but his own.
What is that?
She asked, pointing to his closed hand. He opened his fingers. A jagged shard of silver lay in his palm, glimmering blue and green at the edges.
A piece of the portal mirror.
She sat down on the bench next to him. Can you see anything in it? He turned it a little, letting the light run over it like water.
Bits of sky, trees, a path. I keep angling it, trying to see the manor house. My father.
Valentine, she corrected. Why would you want to see him?
I thought maybe I could see what he was doing with the mortal cup, he said reluctantly. Where it was.
Chase, that's not our responsibility anymore. Not our problem. Now that the Clave finally knows what happened, the Lightwoods are rushing back. Let them deal with it. Now he did look at her. She wondered how it was that they could be brother and sister and look so little alike. Couldn't she have at least gotten the curling dark lashes or the angular cheekbones? It hardly seemed fair.
He said, When I looked through the portal and saw Idris, I knew exactly what Valentine was trying to do, that he wanted to see if I'd break, and it didn't matter. I still wanted to go home more badly than I could have imagined.
She shook her head. I don't see what's so great about Idris. It's just a place, the way you and Hodge talk about it. She broke off. He closed his hand over the shard again.
I was happy there. It was the only place I was ever happy like that.
Clary plucked a stem from a nearby bush and began to denude it of its leaves. You felt sorry for Hodge. That's why you didn't tell Alec and Isabel what he really did. He shrugged. They'll find out eventually, you know.
I know, but I won't be the one who told them.
Jace. The surface of the pond was green with fallen leaves. How could you have been happy there? I know what you thought, but Valentine was a terrible father. He killed your pets, lied to you, and I know he hit you. Don't even try to pretend he didn't. A flicker of a smile ghosted across Jace's face.
Only on alternate Thursdays.
Then how could...
It was the only time I ever felt sure about who I was, where I belonged. It sounds stupid, but...
He shrugged.
I kill demons because it's what I'm good at and what I was taught to do. But it isn't who I am. And I'm partly good at it because after I thought my father had died, I was cut free. No consequences, no one to grieve. No one who had a stake in my life because they'd been part of giving it to me.
His face looked as if it had been carved out of something hard.
I don't feel that way anymore.
The stem was entirely denuded of leaves. Clary threw it aside.
Why not? Because of you, he said. If it weren't for you, I would have gone with my father through the portal. If it weren't for you, I would go after him right now.
Clary stared down into the clogged pond. Her throat burned.
I thought I made you feel unsettled. It's been so long, he said simply, that I think I was unsettled by the idea of feeling like I belonged anywhere. But you made me feel like I belong.
I want you to go somewhere with me, she said abruptly. He looked at her sideways. Something about the way his light gold hair fell into his eyes made her feel unbearably sad.
Where?
I was hoping you'd come to the hospital with me.
I knew it.
His eyes narrowed until they looked like the edges of coins.
Clary, that woman. She's your mother too, Jace. I know, he said. But she's a stranger to me. I only ever had one parent and he's gone. Worse than dead.
I know. And I know there's no point in telling you how great my mom is. What an amazing, terrific, wonderful person she is, and that you'd be lucky to know her. I'm not asking this for you. I'm asking for me. I think if she heard your voice...
Then what?
She might wake up. She looked at him steadily. He held her gaze, then broke it with a smile, crooked and a little battered, but a real smile.
Fine, I'll go with you.
He stood up.
You don't have to tell me good things about your mother, he added. I already know them.
Do you? He shrugged slightly.
She raised you, didn't she?
He glanced toward the glass roof.
The sun's almost set.
Clary got to her feet. We should head out to the hospital. I'll pay for the cab, she added as an afterthought. Luke gave me some cash.
That won't be necessary.
Jace's smile widened.
Come on, I've got something to show you.
But where did you get it? Clary demanded, staring at the motorcycle perched at the edge of the cathedral's roof. It was a shiny poison green, with silver-rimmed wheels and bright flames painted on the seat.
Magnus was complaining that someone had left it outside his house the last time he had a party, said Jace. I convinced him to give it to me.
And you flew it up here?
She was still staring. Uh-huh. I'm getting pretty good at it.
He swung a leg over the seat and beckoned her to come and sit behind him.
Come on, I'll show you.
Well, at least you know it works this time, she said, getting on behind him. If we crash into the parking lot of a Key Food, I'll kill you. You know that?
Don't be ridiculous, said Jace. There are no parking lots on the Upper East Side. Why drive when you can get your groceries delivered?
The bike started with a roar, drowning out his laugh. Shrieking, Clary grabbed hold of his belt as the bike hurtled down the slanted roof of the Institute and launched itself into space. The wind tore her hair as they rose up, up over the cathedral, up above the roofs of the nearby high-rises and apartment buildings. And there it was, spread out before her like a carelessly opened jewelry box. This city more populous and more amazing than she had ever imagined. There was the Emerald Square of Central Park, where the fairy courts met on midsummer evenings. There were the lights of the clubs and bars downtown, where the vampires danced the nights away at Pandemonium. There the alleys of Chinatown, down which the werewolves slunk at night, their coats reflecting the city's lights. There walked warlocks in all their bat-winged, cat-eyed glory. And here, as they swung out over the river, she saw the darting flash of multicolored tails under the silvery skin of the water, the shimmer of long, pearl-strewn hair, and heard the high, rippling laughter of the mermaids. Jace turned to look over his shoulder, the wind whipping his hair into tangles.
What are you thinking? He called back to her.
Just how different everything down there is now, you know, now that I can see.
Everything down there is exactly the same, he said, angling the cycle toward the East River.
They were heading toward the Brooklyn Bridge again.
You're the one that's different.
Her hands tightened convulsively on his belt as they dipped lower and lower over the river.
Jace, don't worry.
He sounded maddeningly amused.
I know what I'm doing. I won't drown us.
She squinted her eyes against the tearing wind. Are you testing what Alex said about some of these bikes being able to go underwater?
No.
He leveled the bike out carefully as they rose from the river's surface.
I think that's just a story.
But Jace, she said, all the stories are true. She didn't hear him laugh, but she felt it, vibrating through his rib cage and into her fingertips. She held on tightly as he angled the cycle up, gunning it so that it shot forward and darted up the side of the bridge like a bird freed from a cage. Her stomach dropped out from under her as the silver river spun away and the spires of the bridge slid under her feet. But this time, Clary kept her eyes open so that she could see it all.
The Mortal Instruments Book 1, City of Bones, was written by Cassandra Clare and read by Mae Whitman. It was recorded by Wes Dewberry at the Invisible Studios in Los Angeles. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Joanna Solotaroff. City of Bones was produced and directed by Christina Zarafanidis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Mortal Instruments Book 1, City of Bones, is available in hardcover from Margaret K. McElderry Books. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, The Mortal Instruments, Book 2, City of Ashes, Book 3, City of Glass, both read by Natalie Moore, Book 4, City of Fallen Angels, read by Molly C. Quinn and Ed Westwick, and Book 5, City of Lost Souls, read by Molly C. Quinn. And now, an excerpt from the first book in Cassandra Clare's The Infernal Devices Trilogy, the prequel to the Mortal Instruments series, read by Jennifer Ely. Travel back to Victorian London with an earlier generation of shadow hunters.
London, April 1878. The demon exploded in a shower of ichor and guts. William Herondale jerked back the dagger he was holding, but it was too late. The viscous acid of the demon's blood had already begun to eat away at the shining blade. He swore and tossed the weapon aside. It landed in a filthy puddle and commenced smoldering like a doused match. The demon itself, of course, had vanished, dispatched back to whatever hellish world it had come from, though not without leaving a mess behind.
"Jem," Will called, turning around. "Where are you? Did you see that? Killed it with one blow. Not bad, eh?"
But there was no answer to Will's shout. His hunting partner had been standing behind him in the damp and crooked street a few moments before, guarding his back, Will was positive. But now Will was alone in the shadows. He frowned in annoyance. It was much less fun showing off without Jem to show off, too. He glanced behind him to where the street narrowed into a passage that gave on to the black, heaving water of the Thames in the distance. Through the gap, Will could see the dark outlines of docked ships, a forest of masts like a leafless orchard. No Jem there. Perhaps he had gone back to Narrow Street in search of better illumination. With a shrug, Will headed back the way he had come. Narrow Street cut across Limehouse, between the docks beside the river and the cramped slums spreading west toward Whitechapel. It was as narrow as its name suggested, lined with warehouses and lopsided wooden buildings. At the moment it was deserted. Even the drunks staggering home from the grapes up the road had found somewhere to collapse for the night. Will liked Limehouse. Liked the feeling of being on the edge of the world, where ships left each day for unimaginably far ports. That the area was a sailor's haunt, and consequently full of gambling hells, opium dens, and brothels didn't hurt either. It was easy to lose yourself in a place like this. He didn't even mind the smell of it. Smoke and rope and tar, foreign spices mixed with the dirty river water smell of the Thames. Looking up and down the empty street, he scrubbed the sleeve of his coat across his face, trying to rub away the ichor that stung and burned his skin. The cloth came away stained green and black. There was a cut on the back of his hand, too, a nasty one. He could use a healing rune, one of Charlotte's preferably. She was particularly good at drawing erazes. A shape detached itself from the shadows and moved toward Will. He started forward, then paused. It wasn't Jem, but rather a mundane policeman wearing a bell-shaped helmet, a heavy overcoat, and a puzzled expression. He stared at Will, or rather through Will. However accustomed Will had become to glamour, it was always strange to be looked through as if he weren't there. Will was seized with the sudden urge to grab the policeman's truncheon and watch while the man flapped around trying to figure out where it had gone. But Jem had scolded him the few times he'd done that before, and while Will never really could understand Jem's objections to the whole enterprise, it wasn't worth making him upset. With a shrug and a blink, the policeman moved past Will, shaking his head and muttering something under his breath about swearing off the gin before he truly started seeing things. Will stepped aside to let the man pass, then raised his voice to a shout.
"James Carstairs! Jem! Where are you, you disloyal bastard?"
This time a faint reply answered him.
"Over here. Follow the witchlight."
Will moved toward the sound of Jem's voice. It seemed to be coming from a dark opening between two warehouses. A faint gleam was visible within the shadows, like the darting light of a will-o'-the-wisp.
"Did you hear me before? That shack's demon thought it could get me with its bloody great pincers, but I cornered it in an alley."
"Yes, I heard you." The young man who appeared at the mouth of the alley was pale in the lamplight, paler even than he usually was, which was quite pale indeed. He was bareheaded, which drew the eye immediately to his hair. It was an odd, bright silver color, like an untarnished shilling.
His eyes were the same silver, and his fine-boned face was angular, the slight curve of his eyes the only clue to his heritage. There were dark stains across his white shirt front, and his hands were thickly smeared with red. Will tensed. "You're bleeding. What happened?"
Jem waved away Will's concern.
"It's not my blood." He turned his head back toward the alley behind him. "It's hers."
Will glanced past his friend into the thicker shadows of the alley. In the far corner of it was a crumpled shape, only a shadow in the darkness, but when Will looked closely, he could make out the shape of a pale hand and a wisp of fair hair.
"A dead woman?" Will asked. "A mundane?" "A girl, really. Not more than 14.
At that, Will cursed with great volume and expression. Jem waited patiently for him to be done.
"If we'd only happened along a little earlier," Will said finally. "That bloody demon. That's the peculiar thing. I don't think this is the demon's work,"
Jem frowned.
"Shaq's demons are parasites, brood parasites. It would have wanted to drag its victim back to its lair to lay eggs in her skin while she was still alive. But this girl, she was stabbed repeatedly. And I don't think it was here, either. There simply isn't enough blood in the alley. I think she was attacked elsewhere, and she dragged herself here to die of her injuries."
"But the Shaq's demon.
I'm telling you, I don't think it was the Shaq's. I think the Shaq's was pursuing her, hunting her down for something or someone else."
"Shaxes have a keen sense of scent," Will allowed. "I've heard of warlocks using them to follow the tracks of the missing, and it did seem to be moving with an odd sort of purpose." He looked past Jem at the pitiful smallness of the crumpled shape in the alley.
"You didn't find the weapon, did you?"
"Here." Jem drew something from inside his jacket, a knife wrapped in white cloth.
"It's a sort of misericord or hunting dagger. Look how thin the blade is."
Will took it. The blade was indeed thin, ending in a handle made of polished bone. The blade and hilt both were stained with dried blood. With a frown, he wiped the flat of the knife across the rough fabric of his sleeve, scraping it clean until a symbol, burned into the blade, became visible. Two serpents, each biting the other's tail, forming a perfect circle.
"Ouroboros," Jem said, leaning in close to stare at the knife. "A double one. Now what do you think that means?"
"The end of the world," said Will, still looking at the dagger, a small smile playing about his mouth.
"And the beginning."
Jem frowned.
"I understand the symbology, William. I meant, what do you think its presence on the dagger signifies?"
The wind off the river was ruffling Will's hair. He brushed it out of his eyes with an impatient gesture and went back to studying the knife.
"It's an alchemical symbol, not a warlock or downworlder one. That usually means humans, the foolish mundane sort who think trafficking in magic is the ticket for gaining wealth and fame.
The sort who usually end up a pile of bloody rags inside some pentagram," Jem sounded grim.
"The sort who like to lurk about the downworld parts of our fair city."
After wrapping the handkerchief around the blade carefully, Will slipped it into his jacket pocket.
"Do you think Charlotte will let me handle the investigation?"
"Do you think you can be trusted in Downworld? The gambling hells, the dens of magical vice, the women of loose morals?"
Will smiled the way Lucifer might have smiled moments before he fell from heaven.
"Would tomorrow be too early to start looking, do you think?"
Jem sighed. "Do what you like, William. You always do."
Southampton, May. Tessa could not remember a time when she had not loved the clockwork angel. It had belonged to her mother once, and her mother had been wearing it when she died. After that, it had sat in her mother's jewelry box until her brother, Nathaniel, took it out one day to see if it was still in working order. The angel was no bigger than Tessa's pinky finger, a tiny statuette made of brass with folded bronze wings no larger than a cricket's. It had a delicate metal face with shut crescent eyelids and hands crossed over a sword in front. A thin chain that looped beneath the wings allowed the angel to be worn around the neck like a locket. Tessa knew the angel was made out of clockwork because if she lifted it to her ear, she could hear the sound of its machinery, like the sound of a watch. Nate had exclaimed in surprise that it was still working after so many years, and he had looked in vain for a knob or a screw or some other method by which the angel might be wound. But there had been nothing to find. With a shrug, he'd given the angel to Tessa. From that moment, she'd never taken it off. Even at night, the angel lay against her chest as she slept, its constant tick-tock, tick-tock, like the beating of a second heart. She held it now, clutched between her fingers, as the Maine nosed its way between other massive steamships to find a spot at the Southampton dock. Nate had insisted that she come to Southampton instead of Liverpool, where most transatlantic steamers arrived. He had claimed it was because Southampton was a much pleasanter place to arrive at, so Tessa couldn't help being a little disappointed by this, her first sight of England. It was drearily gray. Rain drummed down onto the spires of a distant church, while black smoke rose from the chimneys of ships and stained the already dull-colored sky. A crowd of people in dark clothes holding umbrellas stood on the docks. Tessa strained to see if her brother was among them, but the mist and spray from the ship were too thick for her to make out any individual in great detail. Tessa shivered. The wind off the sea was chilly. All of Nate's letters had claimed that London was beautiful, the sun shining every day. Well, Tessa thought, hopefully the weather there was better than it was here, because she had no warm clothes with her, nothing more substantial than a woolen shawl that had belonged to Aunt Harriet, and a pair of thin gloves. She had sold most of her clothes to pay for her aunt's funeral, secure in the knowledge that her brother would buy her more when she arrived in London to live with him. A shout went up. The Maine, its shining black-painted hull gleaming wet with rain, had anchored, and tugs were plowing their way through the heaving gray water, ready to carry baggage and passengers to the shore. Passengers streamed off the ship, clearly desperate to feel land under their feet. So different from their departure from New York. The sky had been blue then, and a brass band had been playing. Though, with no one there to wish her goodbye, it had not been a merry occasion. Hunching her shoulders, Tessa joined the disembarking crowd. Drops of rain stung her unprotected head and neck like pinpricks from icy little needles, and her hands inside their insubstantial gloves were clammy and wet with rain. Reaching the quay, she looked around eagerly, searching for a sight of Nate. It had been nearly 2 weeks since she'd spoken to a soul, having kept almost entirely to herself on board the Maine. It would be wonderful to have her brother to talk to again. He wasn't there. The wharves were heaped with stacks of luggage and all sorts of boxes and cargo, even mounds of fruit and vegetables wilting and dissolving in the rain. A steamer was departing for Le Havre nearby, and damp-looking sailors swarmed close by Tessa, shouting in French. She tried to move aside, only to be almost trampled by a throng of disembarking passengers hurrying for the shelter of the railway station. But Nate was nowhere to be seen.
"You are Miss Gray." The voice was guttural, heavily accented.
A man had moved to stand in front of Tessa. He was tall and was wearing a sweeping black coat and a tall hat, its brim collecting rainwater like a cistern. His eyes were peculiarly bulging, almost protuberant, like a frog's, his skin as rough-looking as scar tissue. Tessa had to fight the urge to cringe away from him. But he knew her name. Who here would know her name except someone who knew Nate, too? "Yes?"
"Your brother sent me. Come with me."
"Where is he?" Tessa demanded, but the man was already walking away. His stride was uneven, as if he had a limp from an old injury. After a moment, Tessa gathered up her skirts and hurried after him. He wound through the crowd, moving ahead with purposeful speed. People jumped aside, muttering about his rudeness as he shouldered past, with Tessa nearly running to keep up. He turned abruptly around a pile of boxes and came to a halt in front of a large, gleaming black coach. Gold letters had been painted across its side, but the rain and mist were too thick for Tessa to read them clearly. The door of the carriage opened and a woman leaned out. She wore an enormous plumed hat that hid her face.
"Miss Teresa Gray?"
Tessa nodded. The bulging-eyed man hurried to help the woman out of the carriage, and then another woman following after her. Each of them immediately opened an umbrella and raised it, sheltering themselves from the rain. Then they fixed their eyes on Tessa. They were an odd pair, the women. One was very tall and thin, with a bony, pinched face. Colorless hair was scraped back into a chignon at the back of her head. She wore a dress of brilliant violet silk, already spattered here and there with splotches of rain, and matching violet gloves. The other woman was short and plump, with small eyes sunk deep into her head. The bright pink gloves stretched over her large hands made them look like colorful paws.
"Teresa Gray," said the shorter of the two. "What a delight to make your acquaintance at last. I am Mrs. Black, and this is my sister, Mrs. Dark. Your brother sent us to accompany you to London."
Tessa, damp, cold, and baffled, clutched her wet shawl tighter around herself. "I don't understand. Where's Nate? Why didn't he come himself?"
"He was unavoidably detained by business in London. Mortmain's couldn't spare him. He sent ahead a note for you, however."
Mrs. Black held out a rolled-up bit of paper, already dampened with rain. Tessa took it and turned away to read it. It was a short note from her brother apologizing for not being at the docks to meet her, and letting her know that he trusted Mrs. Black and Mrs. Dark. "I call them the Dark Sisters, Tessie, for obvious reasons, and they seem to find the name agreeable," to bring her safely to his house in London. They were, his note said, his landladies as well as trusted friends, and they had his highest recommendation. That decided her. The letter was certainly from Nate. It was in his handwriting, and no one else ever called her Tessie. She swallowed hard and slipped the note into her sleeve, turning back to face the sisters. "Very well," she said, fighting down her lingering sense of disappointment. She had been so looking forward to seeing her brother. "Shall we call a porter to fetch my trunk?"
"No need, no need."
Mrs. Dark's cheerful tone was at odds with her pinched gray features.
"We've already arranged to have it sent on ahead."
She snapped her fingers at the bulging-eyed man who swung himself up into the driver's seat at the front of the carriage. She placed her hand on Tessa's shoulder.
"Come along, child. Let's get you out of the rain."
As Tessa moved toward the carriage, propelled by Mrs. Dark's bony grip, the mist cleared, revealing the gleaming golden image painted on the side of the door. The words, "The Pandemonium Club," curled intricately around two snakes biting each other's tails, forming a circle. Tessa frowned. "What does that mean?"
"Nothing you need worry about,"
said Mrs. Black, who had already climbed inside and had her skirts spread out across one of the comfortable-looking seats. The inside of the carriage was richly decorated with plush purple velvet bench seats facing each other, and gold-tasseled curtains hanging in the windows. Mrs. Dark helped Tessa up into the carriage, then clambered in behind her. As Tessa settled herself on the bench seat, Mrs. Black reached to shut the carriage door behind her sister, closing out the gray sky. When she smiled, her teeth gleamed in the dimness as if they were made out of metal.
"Do settle in, Teresa. We've a long ride ahead of us."
Tessa put a hand to the clockwork angel at her throat, taking comfort in its steady ticking as the carriage lurched forward into the rain.